This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Right. Can y'all hear me all right? So it's so wonderful to see all of you. I admit I'm pretty nervous because this is definitely still work in progress. As I kind of dug through some of these stories, one of the fortunate things is so many of these early founding members of our parish are actually quite well known in Texas history, so it's easy to find some of this information about them. On the other hand, that makes it kind of overwhelming. It's like, well, how do I tell any kind of, you know, coherent story? I also wanted to note that a lot of this research is not my primary research. It really comes from the work of people who preceded me. I don't know who the WPA historian, the main historian was, but that historian gathered lots of oral histories from lots of folks who remembered their parents, their grandparents. And those records are in our archives. Also, Daisy Barrett Tanner, her published history in 1976 is a foundation for a lot of this. And then Beth Fowler with the Spirit of the Missions recounted a lot of that as well. And so some of these stories are there. Some of those are not. I tried to kind of add some dimensions. I also want to acknowledge the work of Sandy Boone, who is the chair of our St. David's 175th commemoration. And she found a lot of the kind of profiles of the first four women I'm going to talk about in this. And Mitty Murr, our archivist, Virginia Phillips, archivist, their work has been really crucial. And lots of other folks, I noticed lots of folks who conducted oral histories, who transcribed oral histories, who typed notes. That was really nice because when you're trying to read a lot of handwriting, it really. So I was, thank goodness for all of the wonderful people who typed all of these notes for me. I was thinking about Father Chad's sermon, which I just heard before came in here, and he talked about shared work. And I think that's true for this as well. So I wanted to start with, our first kind of official rector, as we know, is Edward Fontaine. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the rectors this time because I devoted a lot of time to them. I'm going to focus on parishioners, but I do want to note in the Spirit of the Missions in 1852, he writes about kind of the beginnings of St. David's. And this was actually the formation of was called Christ Church in 1848. He says, a parish was organized in Austin by the Reverend Charles Gillette in 1848. This useful minister and our excellent bishop, during a short visit, preached several times to the citizens, and although they were the first and the last services of the church which they received previous to my coming among them, the fruit of their labor remains. And so he then starts to talk about kind of the formation of Austin. He was there in those early days in 1841. He also then comes back in the early 1850s, and he is forming kind of kind of reforming this group with a lot of the same families, and then he's calling that the Church of the Epiphany. So that is what kind of starts in 1851. And when he writes this, he's kind of in the midst of fundraising and building the building, right, which ultimately is completed in 1855. And that, so we've got Christ Church for those first 2 years, and then Church of the Epiphany from 1851 to 1859. I'll talk about a second Christ Church that comes, and then the official name St. David starts in 1859. So it's lots of different names in there. So I just wanted to give a little bit of that context. Also, he also has this nice kind of recollection of Austin in the 1850s, which reminds me in some ways of today. He's talking about a crowded city, lots of folks continually pouring in, streets filled with the rubbish of new buildings. And there is not half enough labor and stone, nor a sufficient number of mechanics to supply the demand for materials and labor. And of course, today we see lots of new, you know, cranes and condos, right? But in some ways, the 1850s in Austin is much like today, a kind of rapidly growing city. In the 1840s, though, it was not. It was just the beginning of it getting established as a capital, but it's not really a secure capital in that decade. And so the population from 1840 to 1848, it actually kind of drops significantly. Part of that is, so there were about 500, well, I've seen the number 500, I've seen the number 800 in 1840. So somewhere in between there, but it drops drastically. Some estimate it to almost like down to like 200 at the end of 1840s. And that's because there is so much chaos in those years of the Republic. And Austin was really on the kind of margins of the Republic. That's part of why there was this debate about whether the capital should be here in Austin or whether it should be in Houston, because it was so vulnerable. And in 1842, in fact, you know, San Antonio had been recaptured by Mexican troops, and Sam Houston was really afraid that Austin was going to be next, right? So that's why he tries to get the capital moved back to Houston. And then there's the Archives War, and they try to keep the archives here to keep it, make sure that it stays in Austin. Lots of the folks in St. David's founding families were part of all of those struggles as well. But, and I'm saying all of this really quickly and summarily, but I just wanted to kind of note what a kind of tenuous time that first decade was. But when Austin gets kind of officially established as the capital in 1848 and 1850, that's when they said, okay, the Episcopal Church says, okay, so yeah, we'll establish a church. Now it's good to really kind of start to kind of build firmer foundations. So I want, as talking about these kind of four women sort of founders of the church, they were sort of, Edward Fontaine noted, they were kind of the nucleus of this church. And a number of other women who were crucial to the formation of the church. I was looking at some of their stories, and I looked at, there was a dissertation written by Ryan Lee Fletcher in 2013. It was about the Protestant Episcopal Church in the South. And he talks about the crucial role that women played in general in reviving the Episcopal Church. And he calls a lot of these women shadow vestry women. I really like that term. This is not a term that they use themselves, but I think it's kind of a useful way of understanding how important, and Bishop Gregg, Reverend Fontaine, Reverend Gillette, a lot of other rectors and bishops recognized the vital role that these women played in the Episcopal Church. It would not exist were it not for the work of women. In these early years, and I would say today as well. So this was why I put that term there. They talked about themselves and kind of used Dorcas or Tabitha, right, as kind of a biblical role model, known for her good works and charity and service. And there were actually kind of sort of Dorcas ministries or Dorcas societies that were created at this time too. So they used that as a reference. So the first woman, Margaret Johnson Raymond. In the Austin History Center, Sandy found this, that she was born in Ohio. Both of her parents died before she was five. She moved to Texas with her brother at the age of 18. The only other things that I didn't find any more than Sandy found so far, but she and James Hervey Raymond, their marriage was Reverend Gillette's first marriage that he conducted in Texas. That's when he was rector of Christ Church, Houston. So her husband, James Hervey Raymond, did lots of things. A lot of these men honestly had lots of roles and hard to kind of condense into a few things, but he served in the Republic of Texas House of Representatives. He was acting treasurer under President Lamar, and he was the secretary of the committee framing the Texas state constitution. He also was the treasurer of state of Texas, 1848 to 1846 to 1858. So very prominent person in Texas history. He then becomes a banker. He joins with another parishioner, John Milton Swisher. And he is in that first vestry of the Church of the Epiphany in 1851. We don't have a list of all the communicants of the Church of the Epiphany, but we do have lists of vestry members in its early years. So Hannah Marie Evans Haney, she was married in 1841 to Dr. Samuel Garner Haney, who is the first junior warden of the Church of the Epiphany. Hannah, I think, has a really interesting, so Minnie was contacted by a family who's doing research on the Haney family. And so from that, I got some more information on Hannah's life. So she was born in Michigan, and her parents had recently arrived there on land that they surveyed. When she was a child, her 2-year-old brother had drowned. Her 11-year-old sister died of malaria. In 1832, her mother died. And it's after that that she, her father, and her 4 other brothers moved to Texas. They settle around LaGrange. Hannah's oldest brother dies in the Battle of the Alamo. Her father fought at the Battle of San Jacinto. And then after that, Hannah and Francis Task, they ran a boarding school for girls in Independence in Washington County. And when someone encountered them on the road, they said that Hannah was riding side saddle with a pistol tucked into her belt. So all of those images you have of the frontier reel there. and then she marries Dr. Sam, who is a physician to Sam Houston. He becomes the first postmaster of the Republic. He's also serves in the Texas Congress and the state legislature. He later becomes a mayor of Austin as well. They have 10 children. One dies in infancy, and their son George dies at the age of 27. But the other 8 do survive. I don't have all of their stories there, but we know at least a little bit more about Hannah's life from the work that this family is doing. The other 2 women were a mother and daughter, Mary Henderson Chalmers and Mary Wallace Chalmers Green. Mary Henderson Chalmers was married to Dr. John Chalmers. He actually has passed away by the time of 1848 because they moved to Texas here in 1840. They have 7 children, but then he gets into a street fight with someone and he's stabbed fatally. Oh, yes. So he's not a part of St. David's story, right? Because he's passed away. And she dies 3 years after he does by 1851. So she's not part of the Church of the Epiphany, but she is one of these first 4 women in 1848 that meet with Reverend Gillette. And Dr. Chalmers, secretary to the Treasury under Lamar. He also founded 2 newspapers in that era. So Mary Wallace, the daughter, is the oldest. And when her father passes away, her mom and her other younger siblings all move in with her. So she really kind of takes care of all her younger siblings, as well as 5 of her own siblings, her marriage to Tom Green. And Tom Green's probably one of those names that you would recognize in Austin, the Tom Green Rifles. He served in the Texas Revolution. He was at the Battle of San Jacinto. He also was in the Mexican-American War. He was a Texas Ranger. And then he also serves in the Confederacy, and that's where he's killed in 1864. So he is kind of part of St. David's early stories, although he doesn't show up quite as much he's not in the list of communicants. A lot of these folks are kind of not actually in the official communicants lists, which is another mystery that I'm sort of trying to untangle. But his wife, Mary Greene, is definitely a big part of the both the founding of the Christ Church and the founding of the Church of the Epiphany later on. Okay, so another family I wanted to highlight are the some of the Swishers, not all of the Swishers, but John Milton Swisher and his wife, Maria Sims. They were the owners of Swisher, sometimes called Swisher Inn, Swisher Tavern. It was previously called the Bullock Hotel. So that is the place where Reverend Fontaine gathers all these folks that have been kind of worshiping and that more informally, right? And they kind of officially form the Church of the Epiphany when they're all gathered at Swisher's Inn. And that was also, that was like the meeting place in the Republic era. That's where all the politicos gathered. And they had lots of these kind of debates about the sort of the lots of drafts and resolutions were crafted within that tavern. So John Swisher, of course, also becomes, so Maria, she dies in 1870, but so that suggests that she is a part of kind of St. David's early history. I can't find lots more about her specifically yet, but her husband, John Milton, was also kind of prominent in the Republic of Texas and helps form the convention of 1845 when it's annexed, and then he becomes a prominent banker. So he's a lot of the money that kind of helped form St. David's comes from the Swishers. Another woman I wanted to profile was Betty Elgin Gilmer. So her parents, Mary Mitchell Elgin, Dr. John Elgin. Mary Mitchell was very important to St. David's early history, but Betty was officially the first Episcopalian baptized by Bishop Eaton in Central Texas. So that was why, it was part of why there's the Betty Gilmer Guild, right? That's created much later in her honor. But she lives a really long time. She lives well into her 90s, as did her brother. And so in those WPA histories, a lot of those stories are really kind of based on oral histories with her. So she kind of carried the memory of the church when, you know, before it was kind of finally recorded in that first WPA work. And she also talks about, so there's a Swisher Inn, but her mother, Mary Mitchell, also ran another hotel called the Missouri House. And she said that was like kind of the second most popular place. And whereas like the Houston folks kind of like to gather in the Swisher Inn, the Lamar folks gathered in the Missouri House. She was very close to Reverend Fontaine in particular, and she helped kind of talked about her sewing clothes for Reverend Fontaine's children after, I talked about this in another talk, but in 1855, when the church is actually finished and consecrated, within like few months after that, Reverend Fontaine's first wife dies. That's why he doesn't attend the consecration. And so there are those years afterward that Mary Mitchell and other women kind of help raise his kids probably. And so so that is another part of how her story, her brother, John Elgin, also his stories kind of form a lot of those early histories of the church. So the other person, now she is, Amelia Barr is noted in a lot of our history. She was probably one of the most well-known parishioners in the Church of Epiphany era, definitely. So she, her husband was from Scotland. She was from England. She doesn't live in Austin for most of her life, but she does settle in Austin from 1856 to 1866. So she's here during the early statehood and the Civil War. It's interesting that later her husband, Robert, and three of her sons die in a yellow fever epidemic in Galveston. And then she really has to start to kind of fend for herself a lot more. They've lost a lot of their money. So she operates a boarding house, and then she's a governess in New York. And then her writing, actually, she can make money off of her writing. And then she publishes over 42 novels and other pieces during her life. So she was a very, very prolific writer. And she does have these kind of wonderful sort of portraits of her time at the Church of the Epiphany. So I also wanted to just kind of, because it was just getting sort of overwhelming to try to account for all of these other individual sort of biographies, I wanted to just kind of note some general trends. So one, the birthplaces and arrivals, just about everybody in that, I went from the 1859 list of communicants, you know, and then just looked for them in the census, in the 1860 census. And where they said their birthplaces were and all of that, and just tried to find some patterns. So this is just for you. Which state do you think was the birthplace of the highest number of St. David's parishioners? Good. Wow. Robin, thank you. Tennessee. Yes. Overwhelmingly the number one state of... And really, if you know, if you're familiar with this era of Texas history, it makes sense. That's where Sam Houston's from. That's where Davy Crockett is from. Lots of these folks kind of knew them. You know, they're all kind of the same folks. But there were other, you know, lots of others, mainly from southern states, other southern states like Alabama, Mississippi, Virginia, Kentucky. There were others. There was a significant contingent in terms of northern states. The kind of the highest number was from New York, and some others from Pennsylvania, and some others kind of smattered in as well. But there were also significant populations from Europe, from England, Scotland, Ireland, and a Swedish contingent that I'll talk about in a second. I also wanted to just kind of say which families kind of came in which general era. So in the Republic era, from 1836 to 1845, you've got the Raymonds, the Chalmers, the Elgins, the Swensons, the Palms, the Herndons, and the Lees. And then in early statehood, so starting 1846 and then into when we get to the Civil War era, you've got the Bakers, the Barrs, the Kreutzbauers, the Kirks, the Hancocks, the Morrills, the Robinsons, and the Hamiltons. And I know there are other folks in there too, but those are some of the big names, the names that you see a lot coming up in the records. So I did want to say just a little bit more about what we call this, what has been called the Swedish pipeline. So Sven Magnus Svensson, he was really the first person. Lots of Swedish folks, people of Swedish descent from in Texas, it's because of Svensson and Palm. So he kind of led this large scale immigration after he arrived. So there's the East Austin neighborhood of Govale, and then there's also Swedish Hill. So Svensson and then his uncle Svante Palm, Svensson, it needs to be noted, he was an enslaver. He did enslave people, but some people think that he was trying to kind of propose more of a kind of new form of indentured servitude. By what he sort of said was, if you kind of immigrate, you work on one of his, he had a lot of land called the SMS ranches. If you work on the land for a year, then you kind of, it's kind of part of your process of becoming part of Texas. And he does, in the 1860 census, there are about four people listed in his household. So those were four emigrants from Sweden and a number of others. But all of this kind of forms kind of the foundation for the Swedish community in Texas. So I also wanted to note that I've talked a lot about the split, right? The Church of the Epiphany under Fontaine, and then there is growing tension between those who want to secede or want to maintain slavery and those who want to be loyal to the Union. And so the Unionists kind of split from the Church of the Epiphany. They form a second Christ Church and asked Charles Gillette to be their rector. That starts in 1856. And again, there are more kind of names than these, but these were some of the names if you want to kind of know which families went which way. You've got the Elgins, the Boardmans, the Rectors, the Wests, and the Lees kind of staying with the Church of the Epiphany, the Bremans, the Swensons, the Hancocks, the Pieses, and the Raymonds kind of go to Christ Church. So Church of the Epiphany were the secessionists. They were, and most of them were from the South too. The Christ Church were the Unionists, and some of them were Southerners, but most of the Northerners kind of went with Christ Church as well. And the Christ Church met in the old courthouse, and there are lots of accounts in the early St. David's histories about the not so charming accommodations compared to this wonderful church that they just built. But eventually that isn't much of an issue because they do reunite in 1859 when Edward Fontaine leaves. He remarries Susan Taylor Britton, moves to Mississippi. And so the parishes officially reunite in 1859 and are then called St. David's. And that's when we have more of the records. Yes, yes. So for those on Zoom, the building was created, the first congregation in this building was the Church of the Epiphany. And then when they reunite, of course, the Christ Church folks come back and they make an agreement that half of the vestry from each church kind of comes together as one united vestry. And that was part of their way of kind of trying to be as inclusive as possible to these two congregations. I did want to note just some other kind of general patterns I found. I'm running low of time, but so lots of these folks, of course, one of the themes was war, and I just talked about here the individuals who fought in the Texas Revolution or in the Confederacy. I realized later that I didn't note the Mexican-American War, and I would say the Texas Rangers. A lot of these men were frequently at war. There were kind of benefits to that in some ways for the Texas Revolution. If you fought in the Texas Revolution, you got a lot of land. So those first generation, that gave them a lot of kind of benefits in the later Republic. But there were also real costs there. And it depends how you feel about war in general, but it's really sort of painful for me to hear the accounts of some of these men, like I'll talk about Thomas Willis Ward in a minute. He lost part of a leg and part of an arm. That's why he was actually given the nickname of Peg Leg. He must have liked it because it's like in official documents. It's like Thomas Peg Leg Ward. But he also seemed to suffer from significant kind of emotional mental trauma. He was known for a kind of trigger hair temper. He had a kind of famous divorce. His wife, she charged him with abuse. And so I think there's lots of evidence that there were real kind of both physical and emotional scars from all of this. And I will have to note that a lot of these wars were waged to uproot the peoples who were here before. So there is a lot of debate today, I know, about what the Texas Revolution was about. But it was most definitely about inviting white people who were enslavers to come. This was a place where they could continue to enslave people. That was written in the Texas Constitution. Now it said, if you are a free white person, come, we'll give you some land. We'll give you all the benefits of citizenship. If you were Black, free Blacks were not allowed to emigrate to the Republic of Texas. And the Constitution also said that the The Republic could not make any laws that emancipated slaves. So if you were an enslaver and you wanted to emancipate people you enslaved, you couldn't do so without petitioning Congress. If you were Black and you were free and you were here before it was a republic, you had to petition Congress in order to stay here. Otherwise, you would be sold into slavery. So I highlight that just to, so that we know, right, that this was a pretty important part of the history of the republic. And a lot of these folks are the same folks who are crafting these laws, right? All right. So I did want to, there's too much. So two prominent governors, I do want to say that there is an interesting strand of like Travis County in Texas. When you get to the giving up to the Civil War, Travis County is kind of a unionist sort of center, right? And there are some of the most prominent unionists are here. It's the one county that votes against secession. There are other counties that are close, but like San Antonio is kind of close, but Travis County was a unionist. Governor Pease and Governor Andrew Hamilton were two prominent unionists. So Pease was kind of a, now he was also an enslaver, have to note that as well. So people who were supporting the union were not necessarily anti-slavery. They just, it was main, I mean, some of their main motivations were they were part of the republic, right? They saw how much debt was in. It was really, really hard to maintain an independent republic. They were looking forward to annexation to the US, and they didn't really want to secede right away either, right? They wanted to further integrate Texas into the nation. So Elisha Pease is governor in the early statehood period, and then right after, kind of in the midst of Reconstruction, he's regarded as kind of a moderate. So somebody, because he was unionist, he was kind of acceptable, but he wasn't the so-called radical Republican. In fact, he kind of gets, he ultimately resigns because Edmund Davis, who is regarded as kind of the radical Republican governor under Reconstruction, Pease thinks that his policies are too harsh. But I do want to note some of those policies were about allowing African-Americans to vote, right? So what's radical at that time? You know, we have to be careful about sort of what we label as radical. You know, a lot of things are radical at that time are now things that we wish we were radicals, right, about. And Andrew Hamilton was more radical than Pease. He is appointed temporarily as a governor. He later runs against Edmund J. Davis, though, because while he is definitely anti-slavery, he also is kind of ambivalent about Black suffrage. I will also say that during the war, so Pease kind of manages to stay around, just kind of stays quiet. Hamilton was, because he was much more vocal, kind of anti-secession, he eventually had to flee, and his house was burned down. Svensson also fled to Mexico and then to New York. He never comes back. So a lot of these unionists, as the war goes on, are really forced out of the state, if they have the means to get out of the state. All right, there were also four mayors in this early part that I noted. So Thomas Willis Ward, that's Peg Leg. He was mayor a lot. So 1840, 1853, and then 1865. He was very important. Sam Haney, Dr. Haney, I talked about before, he was mayor in 1850 and then 1863. George Durham, 1852. And then Ben Carter, who also was killed in the Civil War from 1858 to 1860. So those are the most prominent mayors. I'm sorry, I'm going fast because I want to have a little time for them. Yeah. Yes. Yes, all. So sometimes I didn't always find their actual names. I found like their wives or their kids. Like Elisha Pease, I don't know why he doesn't show up in the communicant list. But he was a representative with Christ Church when they were kind of formally recognized by the Episcopal Church. He was one of the delegates. So that's how we know he's connected. But yeah, it's kind of a lot of mystery sometimes to figure out, were they actual members or, you know, so you have to, their wives were more often listed as communicants than they were. Another place, kind of institution that has a lot of connections to St. David's is the General Land Office. And that's a seat of a lot of power and influence, as you can imagine. Pegleg, Thomas Ward, this is actually where has kind of his most significant influence, some have said, because he helps. Remember, there are lots of folks coming in making claims. You know, they're like, well, I'm here, I need my land, you know, lots of competing claims. So he kind of created a better system for recognizing people's claims or managing disputes. So people sort of, his legacy is more related to the General Land Office than anything else. Stephen Crosby was also a commissioner. Robert Kreutzbauer, who was a parishioner, he was a draftsman and a map maker. And this map that you often see of Austin is in 1853. He made this map, and he worked for the General Land Office. Lots of other folks actually associated with St. David's and the General Land Office. We didn't list them all here, but that was definitely an institution that was very important. Lots of advocates for education. So Edward Fontaine and then Jacob Fontaine was one of the leading Black advocates for University of Texas at Austin. Svante Palm collects the largest kind of private library in the state of Texas that he then donates to the university. And Elisha Pease, he really sets up the public school system and most importantly, sets up a way to fund it. Lots of people said it would be great to have public education, but he sets up kind of the first sort of permanent fund for that in 1854. DeWitt Clinton Baker is also kind of recognized as being a part of establishing the public school system. He becomes a school inspector, 1872 to 1877. I found a story of him. He ran the Sunday school here for a while, and he had a carriage that he called the Gospel Chariot. And he would, when going to church, he would gather the children from their homes and bring them to church in the Gospel Chariot. So enjoy that story. And Reverend Gillette, of course, he really, really wanted to form a college, and he kept trying multiple ways. So St. Paul's College in Anderson and then Wharton College had a kind of short history right before the Civil War. A lot of the teachers of that college, like Frank Brown, who was Gillette's main supporter when he got into the conflict with Bishop Gregg, Frank Brown was a parishioner, as his wife was Sophie Wells. Lots of justices and judges. Some things have not changed at all here. I just noted kind of the Reconstruction era justices, Amos Morrill and Andrew J. Hamilton. But there were lots of other judges as well, Judge Joseph Lee, John Rector, George Pascal Duval, and John Hancock. And I'll note, Pascal was also a prominent unionist. He was the editor of the Southern Intelligencer. That was the main kind of pro-unionist newspaper. He got into lots of conflicts with the Texas Gazette, which was the pro-secessionist newspaper. For that, he was arrested during the war, but later kind of returns in Reconstruction. I'm sorry, I'm good. The last thing I do want to note is that there were lots of these early parishioners who were enslavers. So I went through, so the census from 1850 and 1860, they have the regular census and then they have what's called the slave schedule. And what you can see is anybody who enslaved people would record their names as the owner and then they would record the number of people. And so what I did is I went to the 1860 schedule and just looked for the names of people that were on that 1859 communicant list, as well as a few others that I knew were associated with the early church. And so from my rough estimate of about 213 people who were enslaved by St. David's parishioners. Bishop Gregg himself enslaved about 26 people. The person, J.H. Herndon, who's one of the wealthiest people in the state at that time, there were 43 people that he enslaved. And it's also kind of tricky because people would register who they enslaved by where the property was. So Herndon, for example, you have to look at multiple lists, right, for each county to kind of count them, to kind of compile them. Elisha Pease enslaved about 10 people in the 1860 census. So overall, approximately 35% of Austin heads of households were enslavers. And compared to that, St. David's is about 40%. So it's just slightly above average. That tells us essentially how wealthy this congregation was. These were the leaders of Austin. They were the people that formed Austin, that formed the Republic, and then the state of Texas. And so that, you know, power is also connected to the kind of the responsibility and the and kind of what we need to acknowledge about the how much slavery played in kind of growing and sustaining that wealth. One of the things that I do want to do as I go forward in this is, because we don't have a lot of names, right? We know Jacob Fontaine. We don't know a lot of the other names of people who were enslaved. We don't know anything about their presence in this building. And that's a really, really hard to trace. But I do want to, I'm going to look at the 1870 census. Sometimes you can see from the names when Black Texans could actually be recorded in an official census, right, as free people, to kind of find some of those names. We might find some stories there. So that's to say there's a lot of work to be done. There are lots of undertold and untold and fuller stories about the life of this parish. But this is just kind of a brief snapshot of what we have. So thank you. So questions? Yeah, Robin. Yeah. So for those on Zoom, Robin's asking about, can we guess that the church has slave labor connected in the building of it? That's been one of those questions I would love to know more definitively the answer, but yes, quite likely, because there were enslaved people that built a lot of the other buildings at the same time. There has been some work about the asylum and some of the people that Elisha Pease enslaved is connected to the building of the asylum. So I think we can kind of piece it together more, and lots of other folks are kind of doing that work, but because we don't know the contractor for St. David's, that's been the main obstacle, is not knowing who the contractor was. So, but yes, I think it's quite likely.
Thank you. This has been great. My quick question is there a narrative around why the church itself was founded? I mean, there had to be other churches, other competing churches, and certainly Roman Catholic churches. So I'm just curious if there's a narrative around that.
Well, in our history books, it lists that in that first census, 1840, there were 11 Episcopalians. So people who already were connected to the Episcopal Church. There was honestly a lot of competition, right, of the Protestant denominations. So the Catholic Church was kind of in decline in this period. Protestant denominations weren't able really to form before the Republic era. And so once Texas becomes this republic, there are all sorts of missionaries coming in, Methodists, the Haneys. I will say that Dr. Sam Garner Haney's father was the first Methodist missionary here. He did like the first service, Protestant service in English here. So there were these connections to these other parishes, but these Episcopalians, they wanted to create their own parish and their own faith tradition, right? That they came with. It's like people kind of carrying their faith traditions with them, wanting an Episcopal church established. And the Episcopal church itself definitely wanted, you know, they wanted in on this. They wanted to establish themselves in this new territory. Yeah.
When I'm getting research for the 150th, we gave money to St. Mary's to get started and several other churches.
Yes.
So it wasn't all competition. It was.
Thank you. Thank you for noting that. Yeah. So there was, and the place where St. Mary's is was actually the home of the Kirks originally as well. And Willis Robards, I happen to know this from some other research, he was a vestry person here, but he also sold a lot of his big estate to St. Edward's. So a lot of where St. Edward's is now was his estate. So there are these connections definitely to other denominations, including the Catholic Church. But there was also, you know, Reverend Gillette, his main effort to try to like baptize folks was, he was like, well, if we don't do it, you know, the Catholics are going to get them. So I was like this. So yeah, Valerie.
He's written a book called Just a Private. He fought the Civil War for the Confederacy, but he was a photographer and he had a shop right over there on 6th Street. And our house is the historic Oliphant House, which was on the streetcar at High Park downtown. It's probably pretty convenient for him. He met his wife in the St. David's Choir, who was Anna Webb or Anna West? I can't remember right this minute. But she was the treasurer of the Texas Women's Suffrage Association. Kind of interesting. We didn't know that until our house was on the Hyde Park tour of homes. Well, it's strange, like when the St. David's Choir shows up and starts singing in the house, I wonder why it's here. But anyway, I mean, it's just a, you know, here we are, a tiny family members living in the South, built by folks. It was built in 1894. Who remembers St. David's a long time ago? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Lori. I'm going to have to add that to our.
So am I correct in that Jacob Fontaine was originally Edward Fontaine's slave who was then freed?
Yes.
So how much more information or narrative do you have? I know there's a lot out there. It's been covered in some other times, but I was just curious
about
that relationship too.
Well, and unfortunately, we do have, so there is a biography of Jacob Fontaine that's at the Austin History Center. It was done in the mid 80s. And that's to this day, one of the most, there is fortunately a lot about Jacob Fontaine's life that has been uncovered and celebrated and acknowledged. There's a lot to find there. He also went to become a custodian at the General Land Office after the war. So there's this interesting continuing connection. His wife was the cook for Elisha Pease as well. So lots of continuing connections, I would say, but it's hard to kind of, what happens to Jacob Fontaine between when Edward Fontaine leaves and after the war is still a bit unknown, and that might be intentional, right? But yes, there's definitely, fortunately, a lot more about Jacob Fontaine. Oh yes, he started the Gold Dollar, the first African American newspaper in definitely in Central Texas. He also founded about 7 Baptist churches. The Second Baptist Church. Yes.
I should add that Jacob's grandson, Israel Fontaine, is a prominent leader in the African American community. Jazz musician, court member of the Black Sonic Lodge, and also a longtime pastor, significant member of the community.
Yeah.
He just passed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I don't know how many of y'all know, but where we are right now is the Fontaine House. Do y'all know that? And back in the 80s, when we started wanting to add on to the church, the Historical Commission was really active and they wouldn't let us tear the Fontaine House down. And so we had to move it. And it was down by the convention center. We gave it to the Austin History Center and they've never done a thing with it. It's just sitting there like a shack. But it cost us a bunch to move it. And they had to have cranes picking up wires and everything so we could go down there. And they put a glass of water on the front porch of the Fontaine House and picked it up. And when they got down there, they set it down and the glass of water was still perfect.
Well, most of them are in Oakwood Cemetery, I would say. Like that, that's if you, it would be nice. I think Eric Leibrog suggested at some point that we do like a sort of tour of Oakwood Cemetery and find out. It's amazing how many folks are there. I don't know about the Columbary. I mean, there is a, but I think it's after. Okay, so it's much later. Yeah.
All this research is wonderful. Where are you going to go with it from here? What more is there to come?
I don't know. I keep saying I want to move forward in time, but I just keep kind of like in this era. I mean, I do want to write it all out. I think there would be interesting kind of digital humanities projects, you know, that I don't have the technical skill set at all, but, you know, it's just fascinating to kind of think about mapping out these particular places. And there's lots of kind of fun stuff you can do with this data that we could incorporate in, you know, our website materials or whatever. So I don't know, I'm trying to pull this kind of foundational era together for just a kind of old fashioned paper. But I don't know. I think, you know, Sandy has expressed some ideas about what, because we're kind of collecting all of these kind of stories, right? And it kind of leads to, we really need to find new places to keep these things and to, so we don't lose the stories that we're creating today, right? So I don't know, but it's a kind of never ending work.
Thank you. You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.